This is continuing with Jack Pennington on 13 March 1978. But what I was getting at is that the spectrum of Taurus A was so different relative to the other sources. Did you worry at all about what was going on in the Crab Nebula to give this flat spectrum?
Yes, I think that drew attention to the Crab Nebula. What year was that?
This was 51, Pennington and Minute.
Yes. I can't recall anything before 55. I began to be very interested in the Crab Nebula and worked out that the magnetic field there could only originate in a fast rotating star. That was
Is that right?
That was the first, as far as I know, the first suggestion of a what do they call them? Rotors and
spinars
and so on.
Now, where was that? Which paper was that? I'm not sure I have that one on my list here.
That was in the Australian Journal of Physics.
In 56?
56 or 7.
Is this the one on growing electric space charge waves?
No.
No?
It suggested a model of a Crab Nebula. That wasn't in this publication, that was done later. But it did suggest a fast rotating star, not 30 rotations a second by any means. It actually was with a stronger field, you could come out at.
Well, here's the reference, Pennington 57.
Yeah, that'll be the Australian Journal of Physics on in
Volume 10. Okay, two papers actually. So I'll have to check that. And you wanted this thing to get the high magnetic field, basically.
Yes. I considered it to be the only possible way of getting that high and rather uniform magnetic field. In those days, people were talking about compressing the galactic field with the expanding envelope. And that didn't fit. And you couldn't possibly put the flux, the magnetic flux, into a star, but it would have exploded it. So it had to be generated by a rotating star. And unfortunately, I never heard of neutron stars then. Otherwise, I might have gone a little bit further. Mm-hmm. But still, that was the first spinar or magnetic rotator.
Yeah, that's interesting. As far as you were concerned, anyway, you didn't need to have any confirmation in terms of polarization measurements or anything to believe that synchrotron radiation was an important thing. It just seemed to fill the bill. As soon as you heard about it. Yes, okay, well now we come to Cygnus X, and which had always been confused, of course, because of Cygnus A and Cygnus X, and if you have low resolution then it's not clear what's going on. But what did you find in your measurements with Minute on that?
We thought it was an isolated source. Previously, radiophysics, I think it was Bolton, that suggested it was a galactic spur.
What's the difference now between a spur would be an extended region, you mean?
Yes, yeah, a part of a galactic structure at a large scale, and we thought it was a small object.
And I guess current ideas would be that somewhere in between, it is a rather large part of an arm, more or less. Would you say that's fair to say?
I haven't followed it recently. It was an unfortunate choice of a name because of X-ray astronomy.
Right. And was this where it was coined in this paper?
Yes,
I see. All right, switching subjects, you had a paper in the Proceedings of the Physical Society in 53 on very high brightness solar bursts and demonstrating that they could not be thermal and must be ordered motion of electrons. The implication is that there were people at this time that were talking about even these high brightness bursts as being due to just thermal radiation?
Oh, yes. I think it was Ryle who was talked a lot about thermal radiation, and if you worked out the temperature and the pressure, you found that it was quite impossible that the whole thing would blow up.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even give those elementary considerations. They just simply postulated the temperature. Absurd temperatures they were.
I see. But Wilde, of course, at the same time was studying the nature of bursts, and which was incredibly useful to get a handle on the mechanism of emission. Did this not also point to the fact that there must be plasma oscillations going on? Were you influenced at all by Wilde's work?
No, I can't recall.
Okay, let's move on to... We mentioned the Apjay paper. And now it seems to me... See, you were at Radio Physics throughout the 50s, or did you...
I left there... I left there in 1967.
60, okay, so... throughout the later part of the 50s, it seems to me you mainly moved off into magneto-ionic theory and hydrodynamic theory and so forth. We're not so close to the observations, with the one exception of Piddington and Trent with a survey at 600 megahertz.
Yes, that was the last time I was directly involved in radio astronomy, I think.
Right, and what were the primary results from that survey, or how did that survey come about to do it to begin with?
Well, I had access to a reasonably large aerial, 36 feet, I think. Well, disappointingly small, really.
This is the same one that was used for the H1 work by Kerr?
Yes. Prior to that, long prior to that, I'd vigorously suggested a 70 to 80 foot dish. And our drawing officer said that that design was quite reasonable, it wouldn't be expensive. But that was blocked.
Now, roughly when was this?
Maybe 53, 54.
Mm-hmm. And what was the reasoning for it?
Of course he didn't like it. I forget exactly the reasons he gave. He had enough experiments going as it was. He was a cautious sort of person, moved slowly, and there were several experiments going, particularly the one that Wilde took over from Ruby Painscott and others.
Well, he didn't like the big dish either, of course, Fozzie.
That was a shame because it was quite feasible, and the very big dish wasn't feasible in those days. It was a very big engineering project, but a 70-foot one was, because the Dutch built one at the same time.
Right.
They got way ahead of us in that area. We could have done some wonderful work with a 70, 80 foot dish.
It was similar design in terms of an open mesh construction.
Yes.
An alt-as mount.
Yes. You didn't need a closed, a solid surface because our frequencies weren't that high.
But anyway, getting back to this survey at 600 megahertz, how did that come about to do that? You said the dish was available.
Well, the dish was available, and Gil Trent was available, and it only took a small proportion of my time. I was doing mostly theoretical work by that time, and it filled in rather nicely just to supervise that. And then there was a lot of work involved in making the actual plot, making allowances for noise and drifts and so on. It had to be... Everything was done twice, and then the best plot was sort of worked out.
This was a complete survey of the southern sky, and almost all of the northern sky too, as far as that goes, up to 51.
That was perhaps the most advanced survey at that time.
Yeah, at these frequencies.
I
think that's quite correct. I think that probably the most complete thing before that had been Reber's at 480, many years before.
Yeah. Well, he was limited by not being able to see the best part of the sky, and of course that was a lot earlier.
And he had lower sensitivity,
I'm sure. Sensitivity, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, that was very well received. I remember Leiden and Oort was most enthusiastic about that. He tried to get me to collect to transpose it into galactic coordinates,
mm-hmm.
which I wouldn't do. Well, I was too involved in too many other things then. If anybody wanted to use it, they'd do it themselves.
So you just publish it in equatorial coordinates?
Yes.
Well, before we get off into your theoretical papers on various hydrodynamics and so forth, I'd like to ask you questions about Radio Physics Lab as a whole. For instance, it was a very successful lab, as you said before we started taping. Virtually half of the work before the 1950 was done there, and it grew to be internationally recognized. What do you attribute that success to? What do you think were the key ingredients?
Oh, I think that's pretty obvious. Comparable labs, TRE and Radiation Lab, I worked at both of them and I could see who was there. They were almost all physicists from universities, some from big commercial establishments, mainly from universities. And when the war finished, they were just desperately anxious to get back to the universities, which they did, like people like Ratcliffe in TRE and so on, they just disappeared.
And like Dickey.
Now the situation in radiophysics was quite different. For several years, starting before the war, we were well ahead in time of the Radiation Lab. We'd been recruiting people, and peculiarly enough, the people who were most knowledgeable as far as electronics is concerned, they were engineers from Sydney University. It just so happened that that seemed to be a place where electronics was picked up. In the electrical engineering department. I think that was largely an influence of the CSIRO section that I mentioned before,
mm-hmm.
that was stationed there, working right in the department. So we got people like Mills and Cooper and so on, they were engineers and had been recruited directly from the university as students, not as lecturers or professors. And they simply had nowhere else to go.
Mm-hmm.
And the CSIRO policy to not to throw people out.
So it was a younger group at Radiophysics, you're really saying, that they had not established themselves at the universities, but rather they came to Radiophysics as their first job in many cases.
Yes, it was a younger group, and the CSIRO policy of not throwing people out, making almost any effort to find them something to do,
mm-hmm.
and although it was a rather odd sort of thing to start with a group of engineers. Radio astronomy seemed to be the answer, so they stayed. A lot of them were still there.
But still, even though you have some talent, it takes more than that to make it all work. Do you think that was just sufficient? That just in terms of a successful research program.
I think that's sufficient. Some of them were very good research people, but some of them were, a lot of them were, I'd say, mediocre, in no derogatory sort of sense, but average sort of people.
Right.
But they'd had such tremendous training in radar techniques during the war that radio astronomy was relatively easy.
Mm-hmm. Was one of the things, but I mean, these people presumably could have gone to universities here if there had been positions available. Was one of the things that the universities were just not prepared to take people on and offer them research programs and so forth in Australia?
Well, I couldn't answer that. I think that with a sudden ending of the war, they couldn't have accepted such a large group. They may have. I don't know whether any of the radiophysics people tried to get out. Well, some of them obviously did. People like Westphal, they weren't happy there.
But that was after 5 years, though.
They were there for quite a while.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. the other thing I wanted to ask you about is that you mentioned Westfold, but he and you, I think, were, and well, Smerd is another example, but there were not many theorists in radiophysics.
No. Well, the reason again is obvious, isn't it? Because we were there as engineers to do radar engineering.
But nevertheless, it seems like there was a good interaction between the engineers and the theorists, or those that were inclined more towards the theory. For instance, you're co-authoring many papers with Harry Minnett, who was concentrating on the engineering side. Is that fair to say? And you were concentrating on the interpretation of the
Well, when we started, we were both doing the observations, and only when the results started to come in that I began to get interested in the theory of it. I'd done a BSc. At Sydney University, if you're doing engineering, you can take one extra year in the middle and do BSc.
Right.
But if you're engineering orientated, you use that year mostly to play sport and fool around and try to influence you.
If someone asked you in the early 1950s, what do you do, what do you call yourself, what did you answer?
Oh, a radio astronomer, I suppose.
Even that early? In the early 1950s, can you put yourself back at that point?
I think so, because the Moon paper was done in 1947.
Well, the observations were 48 and was published in 49.
Oh, it's late as ever. Well, I suppose even at that stage, I was doing radio astronomy.
Well, what we now call radio astronomy, but I'm trying to... Yeah, I realize it's difficult to...
The term, I couldn't remember, really.
Okay. So what was it that made you shift over into theory almost completely?
Well, I think that it's a matter of interest, and also it's hard to separate the two. Bowen, by going into theory, I sort of isolated myself. And afterwards, if you see a complete list of my papers, I drifted into other allied type of theoretical work that couldn't be criticised as radio physics.
Such as?
Hydromagnetic waves in ionized gas, the four possible waves in a magneto-ionic medium, growing electromagnetic waves. I was still doing some of the allied stuff, solar atmospheric heating and flares.
But it was more theoretical electrodynamics, which could be applied to any number of things in general.
Yes, but that was only at the start. Then I drifted into geomagnetic storm theory.
This is about when now?
Well, the interplanetary magnetic field and its control of cosmic ray variations, Physical Review, 1958. Around about then, the transmission of geomagnetic disturbances through the atmosphere and interplanetary space, 1959. You can see the changeover then. That put me in a little safe alcove. And at that stage, and also at that stage, in my travels in 1956, and subsequently, I'd seen that spacecraft were going to provide an enormous amount of data, and to get into that area could be very good, which it was.
In geomagnetism and so forth.
Yes.
Right.
Well, the Earth's magnetosphere.
Right.
Then in 1959 and 60, I published the first papers showing that there would be a geomagnetic tail.
I see.
And that was, I've seen it in textbooks, that it says the modern theory of the Earth's magnetosphere started with Piddington 1960. Everybody doesn't say that, of course, but some people do. And I think it did. Before that, there'd been Chaplin and Ferraro, and people who'd sort of squashed the magnetic field by the solar wind, but they'd never considered the effects of a frictional interaction, which there must be. And then that draws out a long tail that goes way up behind the Earth.
This trip you took in 56 is interesting. Can you tell me about that and where you visited and what your impressions were of what was going on in radio astronomy at that time?
Yes, well, I'd been isolated up to then, and I hadn't applied for a trip. But I realised that there were a lot of things that you couldn't get through journals, and that you had to talk to all these people if you were committed to a career as a radio astronomer. And there were also areas around that, like spacecraft and so on. And I think it's centred about a International Astronomical Union symposium in Stockholm on cosmic electrodynamics or something.
Oh, yes.
Similar name.
Right.
Alphane and...
That was held in 56.
Right. Yeah. That was IAU symposium number 6.
Right.
A very early one. So I built around that visits to Cambridge and Dodrell Bank, and well, almost everywhere.
Yeah.
Where there's anything going on. Finishing up over with Jesse Greenstein in California.
But what were the striking impressions that you have that you can remember from that trip, relevant to the sort of radio astronomy that was going on in the groups that you saw?
Well, the biggest one, I think, was, but it didn't have to do directly with radio astronomy. It was with geophysics.
Well, go ahead and tell me what it was.
Well, the fact that there'd be a lot of geophysical measurements being done by spacecraft.
But not by spacecraft in 56, or you mean rockets?
Well, starting with rockets and,
right.
And spacecraft, I think, even then were...
Well, they were foreseen.
Envisaged.
Yeah, something. Sure. So it seems to me then that you were sort of shifting fields at this time and therefore were not so concerned with the... but you did visit all these astronomical places, nevertheless.
Yes, I was interested in anything that seemed to offer a good theoretical approach, particularly anything involving magnetic fields and electrodynamics in general.
Mm-hmm. Just out of curiosity, did you ever consider trying to measure the radio polarization of the galactic background in the mid-50s, once the idea of synchrotron was around?
Not that I can recall.
Because, of course, that would be a nice verification of it.
Yeah.
Although it was a tricky experiment, certainly. Now, the various papers that you published, let's say up till 1960, on these theoretical hydrodynamics, did they influence the understanding of the solar burst or anything like this? Once again, I'm not familiar with that. Did they change the ideas on that, or were they only looked at by other theorists and so forth?
Pretty hard to estimate their effect. They were quite effective in one way. The electrical conductivity of plasma, of a magnetoplasma, was not understood in those days at all. In fact, there was a great big gap there. Even the amount of heating wasn't understood. It was thought that the solar corona was highly conducting, and therefore it would dissipate a lot of electrical energy. Alfvén thought that.
Mm-hmm.
It was entirely wrong, of course. And some of those earlier papers, I was working in competition with Cowling. We were just sort of like that, and I first got the idea, which he very graciously agreed with, that an expression for the thermal conductivity of a magnetoplasma as a tensor, completely explaining all the currents that could flow and why, mm-hmm. and the amount of heat that was dissipated.
And this is the late 50s now? We're talking
that'll
about?
Be around 56.
That's the... four possible waves?
No.
General theory of hydromagnetic waves? In an anisotropically conducting gas?
I think that sounds a bit like it.
That's monthly notices 55. But you weren't trying to apply these theories at that stage to radio sources and other things.
Not directly, no. I was,
this
really,
came later. Yeah.
It was really a form of study. I was studying the whole problem. I found out something that hadn't been previously published, I published it.
Mm-hmm. I see.
It was teaching myself, really, more than anything else, I think. It might be electromagnetic field equations for a moving medium with Hall conductivity. That's the monthly notes of 54. But one of those papers, Cowling came to the same conclusion a little bit later.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that since 1960 you've done a lot of things, many of them controversial.
But like I say, I'm cutting things off here, so I think I'll stop there. Unless, have I missed any important things, do you think, in terms of?
I can't think of anything prior to 60.
Okay, thank you.
One more ago.
That ends the interview with Piddington on 13 March 78.